broadcast.
Wow, it's happening to me.
Whoa.
Hello and welcome to episode 440 of the Creating Crowbar, a gaming podcast being recorded on the 19th of November, 2024. It's an hour late in the day, late in the year, and late in the entire arc of human civilization, probably, it sinks ever deeper into shades of despair as all warmth and hope vanish from the world. I'm Marsh Davis, and luckily I'm joined tonight by two bright, gleaming vessels of joy whose hot takes will scythe through the encroaching night like the beam of a lighthouse, boiling away the worries and woes of the world. Of course, I speak of none other than Chris Thurston.
Hi.
And Tom Senior.
Hello.
Gents, have you taken refuge from the elements or wider state of the world in any digital entertainment recently?
Sure have.
I also have. That's pretty much like... So I'm in a state of what my wife calls fun employed, where I'm out of work with a job starting in a couple of weeks' time, whereas apart from the, like keeping the house good, my only duty is to exist until the money making starts happening again. And so in this window, I have been able to indulge some digital entertainment.
Nice. How have you chosen to use this time? And is it the same way you would always typically use it?
Absolutely, yes. It's the same way that I would. Look, so I've done some like sketching and drawing and stuff, and I'm doing some like little animations and hit this and that there. So I'm sort of like in those senses. But what happens is when I do those things is that I get very frustrated and angry with myself. And then I stop and then think about it for ages. And instead, in the afternoon, once my bits and bobs are done and the cat is happy, I do play Diablo, Diablo 4, and listen to podcasts and catch up on the world in that way. But not in a way that is actually useful, in a way that stresses me out more for listening and learning more about what is happening while doing the punching of the demons. So yeah, yes.
That's a whole lot of stuff balancing on Diablo specifically as a stress outlet, which I think it is good for, right? Like it's pretty much the purpose of Diablo.
It is basically, yes. So, but I've been flipping between games. So I've been flipping between that and Metal Gear Rising Revengeance of all the games in the world. But that is... sort of Hideo Kojima Metal Gear game, obviously, but it's an action game, and it's very parry focused and extremely twitch based, and I find that actually more relaxing than Diablo, because I find like the idea of rhythm of impacts coming in and learning the rhythm of enemies and then defeating them by like exploiting that rhythm. Extremely like that is good for my brain. That makes my brain very happy. It's very satisfying, and particularly with Metal Gear Rising Revengeance, it's got a really nice system where there's no block. There are some sort of like dodge moves, but it's not about blocking or dodging. It's about pressing toward an attack, and that is your block. But you can't press anything else. So it's a game about not pressing buttons. So. I should probably start again and describe what this game is. If I'm going to do that.
You don't press buttons.
And then it's great. So this is a third person action game. It's a sword fighting game where you're a cyber ninja with a cool katana, and you press one button to attack repeatedly and do your combos. You've got a light attack and a heavy attack, but the main, you won't last long just mashing stuff. You have to parry, and when enemies come in, a little red light will flash above their heads, or sometimes they'll just do a normal attack, and you have to press the stick towards them and attack and then leave it and do nothing else. And then if you do it with precise timing, you will get a parry where they flinch back and you can counterattack, or it's just a block. So your blocking and your parry is the same command in different timings. And this is actually really cool. Like it's, and it's exploited through with boss fights in different ways. It sort of, I would say it doesn't teach you well enough in the early stage that that's how you avoid attacks, because it says, like the message it gives you is to attack enemies to block, which is completely counterintuitive. So what you do is you mash attacks towards enemies. That doesn't work. It doesn't actually tell you, look, press towards enemy, press towards attack, and then let them attack you, and you will block. Just trust that that's what you've done. And actually, what happens is, after like a few levels and a few restarts and learning this, I'm only like pressing, you know, I don't know, can't give a number on the number of buttons I'm pressing. Actually, like, you hardly press many buttons at all when you're good at this game, because you're sort of seeing a lot of different enemies come in, their attacks coming in, some of them are flashing red, you've got some evasion maneuvers where you can back off, and then you press the back off button, and then you choose an enemy that you're targeting and you want to parry, you want to defeat, and then you wait for them to come to you, they will attack, then you press towards and attack, get the parry, press the triangle button or and then do the counterattack. And then for most normal enemies, you go to a slow motion sequence where you draw your crazy samurai sword and you could chop them into lots and lots of different bits. And you can mash like square and triangle, and that it's all in slow motion, and you can angle your blade with the right stick, and it goes, you know, you press the button over and over again, and it chops them, completely dissects them with each chop that you do. And then when you land, it says, you chop this person into 104 bits. And then you get points. And that is obviously delicious. But what's better is to only do two slices instead of just a million. Obviously, initially you want to do a million slices, get a spectacular chunking enemies into a million bits. But what you want to do is, at the start of the game, in true sort of Hideo Kojima game fashion, an NPC tells you, look, we really need these guys' left hands. Like, their left hands are super important. Like, they've got, like, I don't know, some cyborg chips in them. And I guess if you just bring me loads of their left hands, then I can upgrade you and give you cool stuff. And you're like, interesting. And then, you know, a couple of levels later, a guy will be like, okay, so actually, the way to heal in this game is to chop a guy in half and then take their spine. And what will happen is, when they're in this floating kind of like defeated state, floating through the air, a little square will appear in the middle of their body, and you will slash, or you'll angle your slash like a little mini skill game. And once you've done that, you could press B to seize their spine with your hand, and then crush it in your palm and regain their energy. All your health comes back. It's like a maximum aggression mechanic that looks incredible and is just deeply satisfying every time. And it's kind of like a proto version of even that Bloodborne thing of where you, if you take damage, you can get damage, you can recover health by attacking. So it's attack, attack, attack all the time. And in fact, if you defeat an enemy perfectly, no matter how much damage you've taken, no matter what has happened in this encounter, you get all your health back. You'll get all of your energy back. And then the energy lets you do that again. So it's this extremely good rhythm. It's really, really, really nice. And it's really clever. And I've been having a great time with it. And the boss is obviously hilarious. You get all the Kojima nonsense. I'm not sure that how involved he was, but like the bosses and the sort of like the first sort of boss thing you encounter is a robot dog that claims to be the most intelligent being in the universe. and that just, I was just like, yeah, I just feel like I'm back in Death Stranded here, and I like it. It's fun. So I've had a really good time with it.
So was it recognized as this sort of precision game when it came out, or was it treated as a hack and slash by the reviewers? Because I don't remember it being lauded in the same way that Sekiro was, for example.
Yeah, so Sekiro is a really good example, actually, a really good riposte to it. I don't think it was, because I basically played it because it was a Metal Gear game, and because it was a kind of platinum adjacent type of game, like it was of a particular era where you got like Vanquish and Bayonetta and lots of that type of third person combat. Also the Devil May Cry series, of course, and it kind of fit into that mold. But I'd not played it. I played it. There's actually quite a lot going on. I would say these days it's an ugly game. It's a very brown game. It's got all those kind of like very basic, basic models for the enemies. But the actual combat itself is like really refined and surprisingly good on that basis. And it's the sort of game that I'm definitely going to push through, because there are the bosses in there, obviously just very silly and bullshit and tedious, and they take a long time. There's lots of stuff that kind of holds it back, but I do think it's an overlooked game. And I actually don't know how it was reviewed at the time, because it was before when I didn't pay attention to it before at all.
I think it was seen as a bit of an oddity, because it obviously wasn't what people were expecting from even a Metal Gear spin-off, right?
Right.
Like, I think I played the first half of it. I never finished it, but I think of it now as like a real cult favorite, because I think partly because of its silliness and like, it is, you know, it's generated a lot of GIFs and one-liners over the years. And the soundtrack is a banger in one of those sort of like, you know, kind of over-the-top character action game soundtrack kinds of ways. I think it's also kind of an interesting thing to call out that like, it's an interesting one of like having quite an unintuitive rhythm for what it means to be good at it. But when you find it, it's really gratifying. But again, that feels quite Metal Gear generally, of like, actually maybe not quite Metal Gear, but very Kojima, to be like, there is a way to play this that kind of cracks it open, but it's not what you think. This is not the game that you were expecting to be playing necessarily. Like this sort of, counterattack plus spinal surgery based combat system. I think also just genuinely like leaning in really hard to Metal Gear's most cringe character, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Raiden, like I'll probably get trouble for saying that, but it is true. So,
well, I mean, yeah. And this sort of tries to make him the most, like even with the voice acting, is the most badass guy of all the badass.
There's simply never been a cooler guy.
There's simply never been. And like the bottom half of his face is replaced by his whole jaw is replaced by a metal jaw, and it's like his whole head is a skull. And he's like, and there's a ridiculous bit where he discovers his true power. And I don't know if you can guess what his true power is. Is it? I don't know. The despair about the military-industrial complex that the game bangs on about forever. It's pain. And so a guy stabs him, and he's like, "This." And then he has a whole revelation about the fact that pain is what he's on about. And it's like, all right, oh, it's an anime.
Yeah,
whatever.
It really is.
Like, it's just an anime. That's fine. But it's good fun, and it's like, I wish I could play it on my Switch or something. It's surprisingly hard to get hold of. It's available on PC. And it is a fun time if you like. It's nowhere near as good as like Bayonetta and stuff like that, but it is in that kind of world.
You can parry a robot armed with a sword the size of a commuter train. So
absolutely. Yeah. And the game loves it. And it's like,
and it goes bong.
And it's like, look, what you thought you wanted to press lots of buttons to kill the train, but actually what you needed to do was press one button when it was emotionally important.
Then cut off the train's left hand.
And then rip its heart out.
Yeah, exactly.
Good times.
Indeed. Indeed. But Diablo, though.
Sorry. Oh, gosh. Yeah. So it's already gone on my second rant. But yeah, Diablo is what I've actually been playing in my fun employment period. And Diablo 4 is really good. I really like it. I think it's too grim by half. I really
Are you playing the expansion or the...
No, so I don't have the expansion yet. And as soon as I've got a new job, that's probably that's the first thing I'll buy that and go down there. Hopefully it's a bit more colourful. I think that Diablo 4 responded too hard to the criticisms of Diablo 3 about how Diablo 3 was colourful and had rainbows in it and shiny effects and glowing characters and stuff. And Diablo 4 is just relentlessly miserable place to be in its original state. And as with all Blizzard stuff, it's really beautiful in its own way. Like I can admire the execution of the art, the textures, and the monster design. But to be honest, most of the actual encounter design is lifted from Diablo 3. Most of the sort of when you encounter heroic enemies, like particularly dangerous enemies, they have extra effects, and some of those are kind of like laser beams that will appear. Like it's a Diablo Disco Time when they appear. I think it was Diablo 3, where like a glowing orb will appear on the battlefield, and then a jagged kind of like lightning line will appear out of it, and then will rotate slowly, and then three of those will appear on the battlefield, and you're gonna have to dodge, and you're gonna have to get out of the way, and all of that stuff. And it's got a lot of the sort of danger zone ground effects, where like big red markers will appear on the ground, you're gonna have to dodge out of those as well. A lot of that stuff has been borrowed from things like God of War 2 and lots of MMO design, trying to create a sense of positional awareness and positional interest to combat encounters that kind of gets you out of the simple churn of going like progressing through your skills to deal the most amount of damage at any given point. I think it's effective of that, but it's the same. It is the same as Diablo 3. it is the same. And that's fine because I really like Diablo 3, but it's kind of interesting that loads of people come back to it and be like, wow, this is amazing. I was like, well, the bosses are the same. Like a lot of like the patterns and things that I'm encountering with the major bosses are just like exactly the same as bosses I've fought in Diablo 3. And again, there's nothing wrong with repeating that stuff, but I'm slightly baffled by people who didn't like Diablo 3 coming back to Diablo 4 and what that represents. Is it purely the aesthetics? I'm not sure. It feels as though a narrative was established somehow in the ether about Diablo 3 that wasn't true, and then this game has kind of expressed the same ideas, like mechanically and in terms of design, and it has been met very well. I just thought that was kind of
an interesting one. Like I think Diablo 3 kind of historically, because I love that game as well. I think we played a ton of it right back way back when, and like. But the areas where Diablo 3 was kind of like experiment, it was experimental in a bunch of different directions with that formula, right? And I often think about having now friends and colleagues who've worked on various games in that series, like obviously, Diablo originally always kind of an anomaly for Blizzard, being a Blizzard North kind of acquisition in that sense, and then sort of being quite different to Warcraft and Starcraft tonally. Diablo 3, I think, was experimental in the sense it also brings, stylistically brought it closer to other Blizzard games and their kind of broader Blizzard art style. But also the things people also really remember are things like the Auction House early doors, right? Like the economic experiments, which were kind of like bizarrely, like when I say they were ahead of their time, I mean, I think they made a mistake that it would take other game developers like another decade to make, right?
It was prescient.
It was a prescient mistake, if that makes sense. Like they got there earlier than everyone else and no one should have gone there, but like, still. And that's, and I think obviously Diablo 4, I played the base campaign when it came out, and I know that it's had ups and downs and seasons of changes since, so I've not like played it in its current incarnation. But yeah, I do know what you mean. Like, I think there's a bunch of areas where you can see them iterating on the formula slightly and definitely returning to Diablo 2 tonally. But like fundamentally, like that school of encounter design, which basically states that the classes are different to one another, but they're not that different, right? There are DPS calculus being pointed at a bunch of bats or guys, and some of the guys or bats are electric. And that's something you deal with. And then you can do forward rolls quite powerfully. So, and you kind of just sort of repeat that formula as you kind of like the combination of like encounter complexity because of electric or rotating laser goes up, and your ability to kind of chain more abilities together to do bigger numbers also goes up. And that goes up. Those things increase in sync with each other, more or less forever. Diablo.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
that's really the ladder you climb. Yeah. That's
but it is really, really compelling. Like, but I guess it also has, you know, to the point, like, there is, nonetheless, I think, like, a very pleasing rhythmic quality to that kind of thing. And I was wondering if that's kind of the common element between this and something like more traditional character action game like Revengeance, where they're both kinds of game that induce like a flow state, right, where you can just sort of sink time and effort and attention into it.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting to contrast the two based on like literally how much of or what types of your mental capacity they occupy. So, for example, I play Diablo when I'm listening to podcasts or I've got a support on the second screen. And it's to me, like, Diablo has pretty much always been a second screen game. And in fact, like, when me and Emma are sitting on the couch and watching, we've got, like, Married at First Sight or some silly stuff on television, we've got, like, second screens all the time. I think, like, second, third screening. I think that is just, like, a very, very typical way to engage with games. And I think that Diablo in particular is very well suited to that because even though occasionally if you're going to a big boss encounter, does demand that you go through the motions in terms of actually maximizing the damage that your character, the character that you built, has to output in order to survive, and it might require you to change your build. That engagement only comes perhaps like once every 2 hours as you're leveling up, and then you might hit a point and realize that, oh, so I just got blown up there by this boss, so I need to look at my build and then have a little think, and then reshuffle things and then go back in, defeat it. And that's a little kind of like fun thing, and then in the meantime you're sort of tapping as you're watching other stuff and chatting to your friends. I really think that is it's a bit of an unseen way to play games when it comes to critical analysis of what these things are for. So I'm not saying that reviews should really like review this as that, but I've not seen many articles like actually reflect on the fact that loads of people play games with loads of stuff going on around them, and that is like super common. And loads of people engage with entertainment, like as one screen of many, or while talking to people. And it makes me like think about like South Korean cafes when, the big sort of South Korean MMOs like 15, 20 years ago, like a lot of those were designed so that for like internet cafes where they would be chatting with their friends, and you could play the game as you're chatting and they're both leveling up, and it's a more social, it's a very different thing. It's almost like going outside to smoke. Like, it's almost like, you know what I mean? And this is kind of like a really under-examined part of games coverage, generally, I would say.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because I feel like, not to kind of spin this out into a very arch point, but like if you think about the origins of a lot of game experiences in arcades, which are inherently social and about kind of like simple experiences that people do while smoking or like having a drink or talking to the person next to them, and then the birth of the criticism of those experiences as really actually paying attention to them, like really looking at them, like you end up with this. I'm not saying that the medium as a whole isn't designed for it, but I do think as a medium, like probably more than any other games are capable of like catering to different levels of attention. Like there isn't really such a thing as like, and maybe there is, maybe I'm missing something really obvious, but like writing a book or making a film for people who aren't really paying attention to it. Right. You know what I mean? And I think even when we see like TV particularly start to kind of think about how to take advantage of the fact that this might be being watched on a tiny screen on the bus or, you know, might be a second screen thing. It feels like a really uncomfortable set of compromises for media like that. Whereas games are actually better positioned to kind of take on. It's not a game I was expecting to talk about on the pod, but something I have been playing this week, because I tend to have like a few things on the go at the moment, some bigger investment things that I'm playing, you know, on my PC, or I'm like really thinking about like role-playing games and stuff, but also like now that I have a Steam Deck particularly, but generally I kind of always want things that I will play for 10 minutes, you know, like that kind of like just to occupy myself. I've never been a comfortable second screen person. I just can't do two things at the same time, really. Like there are minor exceptions to that. Like I can listen to music and paint, but that's basically it. Like I can't even like mix a podcast and a game anymore. My brain won't kind of do it. So I'm kind of the opposite in that regard. But I've been playing, because it looked dope and I wouldn't normally be into this, a game called Xenotilt, which I think it's called Xenotilt Hostile Pinball Action.
And wow.
What a nice It's amazing. Sick. It's so it came out very recently. I think it's Hostile Pinball Action. I'll be a coward and check very quickly. It is. I was right. And it's this. It's in that cadre of Steam games, which are just a pinball table, right? Like it costs a tenner, and this developer has spent, I think it's a one person outfit, has just spent a couple of years making one pinball table, and it is. I mean, I won't need to go into too much detail, but it's a really interesting thing. Like it's half shmup, half pinball table. So it has like these other like shmup. You'd like it, Tom, I think.
Yeah, this sounds
yeah, but also awesome. Yeah, like it has like enemies that spawn, and like you can earn ammo for turrets that you can like if you catch the ball and the flippers, you can activate the turrets and stuff like that.
Oh,
but
yeah.
The table itself is this sort of very maybe late 80s to 90s like sort of Cronenberg-y cyberpunk hackerscape kind of thing. Big robot woman, big robot tiger, big robot beetle are the three bosses at different tiers of the table. And like the robot lady is constantly talking to you in like a Shodan voice. And it's completely overstimulating. Like it's just a disaster of particle effects. I mean, in a good way, like it looks great, but it is just like a good shmup, like just the vibes, right? And yeah. For some reason, having that reduced to like, having a go on the pinball table is like a perfect amount of game for me, like three lives and you're out. You know, pinball is sort of arbitrary enough that you have to pay attention to it, but it's clearly like not really designed for that, right? It's to what I'm to the point I'm making, it's a game that you play while having a beer in an arcade, right? And so that
this doesn't look like you could look away from it.
Right. No, you can't really. But also, you actually have to, because there's too much visual information, I think, for you to follow it. So you just have to kind of like, almost like you're like in a Clockwork Orange style, just kind of like let it happen and then try and flip the ball back up when it comes back down again. You know what I mean? And like that really simple, like you just pull in the triggers to like flip a ball into the dopamine circuit of your own mind. Like that's, and it's great for that. Like I think like the reason I picked it up is because I think it just like randomly showed up on PC Gamer and got a 92. And genuinely within the parameters of like you're reviewing a pinball table, I can kind of see that, because it's like, this is
what else is it
fucking
to
sick. Like
yeah. I it's kind of funny because it obviously all works for PC Gamer, and like as much as for lots of people reading review scores and things, it might not seem like there's a methodology, but there are actually like ongoing definitions of boundaries between 70 to 80 and 80 to 90 and stuff. And I can't speak at all for where PC Games are currently, even though, and by the way, I read PC Gamer every day, I love it. But post 90 was like, it should be something post 93 or 4, this is how arbitrary it is, should be moving gaming forwards in some way. It should be introducing something new or some idea that is actually kind of might inspire new stuff. Whereas actually, but actually to get past the 90, you could just make the perfect thing of what it is, of what it wants to be. And if someone wants to make the best, most explosive, entertaining pinball stage ever, that should get 90. If they've made it so good and it's so satisfying, then that should absolutely get a 90 on this game. I love that.
I feel like I have no idea how to judge a pinball table, at all. I know I'm having a nice time and it's fun to load it up and have a go on it, but I truly don't. I imagine that there is a way to know if a pinball table is good. This seems good.
It can't just be that you are good at it, right? There must be some.
Yeah.
I mean, but how? But these what's weird about pinball, in fact, all of the arcade games of yesteryear, is that they were designed to punish you and take your money.
Right.
So yeah. It's hard to know what is good about that. You know, how as a critic do you judge something which is extractive, essentially?
Yeah. Also, sometimes the ball goes the wrong way.
Unfortunately, physics. That's how balls do.
But it is. It's but that's the thing. There's this weird, sort of false honesty of a pinball table, which is particularly a video game pinball table. And it might be the video games are the perfect place for pinball because they can occasionally lie about what ball do. Occasionally, ball can teleport or go into a zoomy pipe or turn into a missile or something, right? Whereas that's not possible in real life, as I understand it. Maybe I'm wrong. Again, I don't know anything about pinball. But then it depends on this contract that you've established with the game that it does actually matter, because otherwise your inputs don't mean anything at all, right? if it was... And so I'm fascinated by the balance of it being totally arbitrary, whether or not you whack the ball hard or punt it a little bit or something like that. I am not making any of those choices. I'm just hitting the ball back into the machine.
I feel as though in these pinball games, this crisis is epitomized by the shunt table buttons and commands that are a part of every pinball game that I've encountered, which is apparently a thing that you can do. Just absolutely elbow drop the table to in real life to shunt a ball sideways, and that's the thing that is often digitally replicated in a lot of these games. I'm obsessed with them because I encountered more of them in US bars whenever I've been over to the States, and you go to some bars and they've just got some amazing table and they're really beautiful machines. They are so precise and incredible. And I love miniatures, so I think that's probably
plays into it. Same. Yeah, right. It's I think there is something about the craft of them that it's this tactile, beautiful way of capturing your attention so you don't realize that you're being entrapped by physics into losing money. You know,
to me, that feels more honest than most gambling.
True. Yeah.
I can see it and I know how physics works based on observed.
Yeah. And if I can just punt a ball into that button, it will make a sound. And that's nice to me.
And then I think I reached a point where with lots of games where I ask myself the question where I'm did that make me happy? Am I happy with the time I spent on this? Yes or no? And actually increasingly games are about attention. And the game's demanding attention and time, and it's about measuring out time more than anything. It's about I've got 40 minutes before I'm doing the next thing to have fun with something. And I think we're talking about sessions, really. It's gaming sessions. So with Diablo, I can dip in, and I'd say half an hour would be a satisfying session with Diablo to do something. With a pinball game, 10 minutes, absolutely. And I feel as though that it might be, more so than genre, a better way to actually categorize games. In a meaningful way for people who actually want to pick something up. So like Destiny, your entire life, not really, but like, I mean, there are games that, when are you going to, how much time do you have to put in to get fun out or to be satisfied? I think, I do feel as though if I was, you know, as a sort of thought experiment, going to redesign how games were assessed, it would be based on session stuff. It would be like, this is a short session game, and it's good based on this, it's bad based on that. I don't know. That's my thought.
Yeah, I definitely think about that a lot from a design point of view. I think having a sense of like intended session types and lengths and how you cater to different needs is a really interesting space, and different levels of attention is like a really interesting, because it's quite, I mean, I think UX encounters this a lot, but it's very tactile to like, it's just very kind of pertinent to like the, basically the physical experience of playing a game and the physical role that the game plays in people's lives, which I think is where games as a medium are so kind of baggy and all over the place, right? Like a game can be literally anything from a like a short game to a game with short sessions that you can play forever, like Tetris, to being huge experiences that are nonetheless played once. And so basically it's like, unlike almost any other medium, both the range of attention supported and the amount of engagement supported overall and the pattern of that engagement is like colossally varied. And I don't think there's an equivalent, really. No. Like in terms of, maybe in terms of other kinds of hobbies and pastimes, there might be some.
How short a chapter is.
Yeah.
Maybe. That's the only kind of comparison I can think of.
Yeah, like just, unless you're talking about like very mixed, I don't know, truly experimental microfiction or something like that. But I don't think as experienced by the majority of its like consumers, not either word, but one nonetheless, like games, that is a kind of, I think we've just figured out what games are like, which is good because we've been doing this for 440 episodes in 11 years. But we got there in the end.
I appreciate that designer perspective, because I'm still coming at it from a kind of like slight like critic perspective and sort of from the other side of things. And I do feel as though people aren't being, there's something missing in the critical approach to games at the moment that isn't quite serving that someone just rocks up and wants to have a certain experience and wants to know, hey, I've got 10 minutes and I like this. What should I play? And AI will probably do that soon, but in some guise, but I don't know. I just thought I'd highlight that as an interesting
one. It's an interesting one. Particularly, I mean, a subject we have talked about a ton on the podcast over the years, including from questions and things, is, you know, the classic example of this in terms of podcast stuff would be, I'm a new parent, what can I play like while I'm nursing a newborn baby or something like that? And all of those questions are really about, I want games to be a part of my life. What games fit now? You know what I mean? Like, and that I think is the kind of,
that's absolutely right.
Highly divisible games, which are good at re-onboarding you once you've put them down. That's what everybody needs. I feel that's a massive problem for me. I don't have any kids, but I have a terrible memory. And so whenever I put a game down, I come back to it. And like, I just, all of the tutorials for the button prompts, they're gone now. I just don't know what I'm doing anymore. I was having this problem. I won't talk about this game at length because I didn't really like it, and it was a disappointment. And I'm, you know, if nothing, a very positive and upbeat person. So we'll scoot on past it. But the Rise of the Golden Idol, which is a sequel to the Curse of the Golden Idol, it's very badly. I mean, it's very. Anti-division, like you can't, it requires you to remember things from several hours ago in a single session unless you want to go through all of your material again from scratch. I find it very hostile. Like I was expecting it to, once you've learned something, you've identified something, like it would keep a record of that in some way, or it wouldn't ask you the same question again, or it would offer up the information you'd already discovered. But instead, it's like asking you the name of a character who you identified 3 hours ago again. I'm just like, no idea now. it's a different day. That's information I have successfully purged from my system.
So this is a adventure detective game, right? Curse of the Golden Idol, where through investigating scenes, it feeds you words that you can fit into a kind of a logic puzzle where you construct sentences that solve the mystery. Is that how it works?
That's exactly how it works, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I knew that you were playing it, so I watched the videos and I just sort of laid out. But yeah, I wondered why that was frustrating, because...
Yeah, the first game didn't have as many of these problems, I feel. Or maybe it was just novel enough in its format that I overlooked some of the problems, and now they are more apparent to me. But there's a bunch of odd choices with ways that they've redesigned it, which make it less mnemonic. So instead of you having to click on words and then harvest them into your dictionary, it just automatically harvests them from when you pick up an item. And sometimes the words are only tangentially related to the item, or they aren't grammatically consistent with the words that you discover in the environment. Or sometimes they are relevant to the overall theme, but the thing you've picked them up from is irrelevant. So if somebody has stabbed somebody, the word stab is obviously a useful word to have in your dictionary, so you can build sentences which describe the crime. But you won't necessarily in the first game, like, you'd click on a detective and then you'd click on their little notebook and they would have written so-and-so has been stabbed, and then you would be able to pick up that word from their notebook. But this time they do lots of weird things where the words you're picking up will be from like something completely unrelated to the crime. Like, it will be just a word on a crisp packet you find, which has no bearing on the investigation, but it just happens to share a word which is related to the crime. So you get it from there, but like, that just doesn't feel like detective work at that point. That just feels arbitrary where you're getting these words from. Anyway, that's completely aside. I wouldn't whine about it, but I have whined about it.
I think that is pretty much exactly the mystery logical arc of the writing of the BBC Sherlock series. Where it goes from being like, yes, he's picked up context clues from the environment in some way. Like, this suitcase is wet and therefore, and it was raining in Cardiff today, therefore this person must have been on that train. Like, kind of Sherlock Holmes stuff. All the way to like, that bird is blue. Do you know what else is blue? Sadness. You know, yeah, precisely.
Yeah. Anyway, so to return to the original point, all of these things defeat your ability to memorize and retain information. Which means that it's no longer like a little game where you can dip in session by session and pick up a little mystery and then move on, and then in another 15 minute session attack another mystery.
So it's like you're sort of like dunked back into a bucket of random things you've seen. It's like floor, ceiling, light, blood.
Yeah,
and then it's like yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, like, I didn't ever finish the first one. I'd really enjoy it, but I had like one, maybe 4 or 5 hour session where I played like 2/3 of the game in one like flow with lots of momentum and felt really good about it. It's Curse of the Golden Idol. Really enjoyed it and then struggled to go back to it. But I wouldn't credit that to necessarily the absence of like reminders or something like that so much as like maybe I just hit that point where I felt like I'd had my fill, like I got it and had fun and I didn't feel compelled. But like I remember the initial experience being like, oh, I'm on a roll here, carrying context through from one sort of scenario to the next and one case to the next and kind of just keeping going. So it does feel a little dependent on momentum, I guess, to as a part of your memory. But maybe that's because similarly just a lot of different people, and I can't remember what any of them are called.
Eugene Marmot is a recurring character in the latest one. If you remember the name Eugene Marmot, that will be like 90% of the boxes you have to fill throughout the game.
Feels like a game you shouldn't a name you shouldn't forget, but yet. Ask me tomorrow on Discord, and I will not be able to remember.
That was a good test. But when this episode comes out, ask us what that name was.
just yell at us in the street. Eugene Marmot.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any other Diablo thoughts you wish to divulge, Tom?
I feel as though I've taken up a lot of the podcast already with Diablo, so if you don't mind me digging
in. Yeah, Diablo.
Welcome it.
I don't have the new expansion, and I will get that in the new year, and I'm looking forward to it. But the great thing about Diablo is that you can just create a new character, and they've all got completely different skill sets and lots of different sort of crunchy theory crafting, you know, endeavors that you can go on in terms of the you can build a character. In my case, my character is a rogue, and she can. I've tried to build a close combat rogue where she stabs demons lots of times, very very fast. And I tried to build that character around attack speed, so that she can just like obliterate things in close combat and then hold things off in a wider range. But also, you could build that character to be a long range character with bows and utilize different skills that push enemies back and then punish them at range. And yeah, going through the kind of progression with the rogue as an RPG character was extremely satisfying, because it forced me to engage with systems that, even though I've played this game a lot, I had not even looked at before. Because you can play as a, you know, a barbarian, smash stuff, and you can play as a necromancer, just summon as many skeletons as you can, and you get through the campaign completely fine and have a really good time. And it's a good video game. Like, you will have a good 20-hour video game just picking a necromancer and going through the campaign. And I think that's a job well done. But what the game's really, really wants to do, and what Blizzard has always really wanted to do with Diablo since Diablo 3, is to make it a game that lasts forever. And it wants the game to entice people who are interested in systems and theory crafting in the way that people got into theory crafting for like raid bosses in WoW. I think they're trying to replicate that level of mechanical intrigue in a much more accessible and a much faster format. And no one could say that they've reached that level of like raid encounter for Diablo 4, but nor should they. But what they have done is left a delicious trail of breadcrumbs for people who have gone through the main campaign, had a really good time, want to go up to high difficulty levels, and it flags up that there are high difficulty levels, greater rewards, more experience, better loot. In fact, the best loot in the game. And as soon as you beat the game, it's like, okay, well, I'll try to go to hard difficulty, or I'll try to go to the torment. And then you get defeated. And then that's the first point of friction in the game, is when you go up past that level. And it's so, so well designed to pull you in, where you go through the game and go through, have all these awesome abilities, you're proud of your character, and you're really pleased with how they look and stuff. Obviously, Blizzard has incredible artists and amazing design. So you're like, okay, I'm going to take my character to the next level. But then you actually have to think about what your character's doing much more than just clicking on random skills that are fun. And you have to be like, okay, so I'm getting blown up in this boss fight. I'm doing fine and I'm getting out of the way of the attacks. But when, if this one particular thing hits me, I get deleted. I'm just dead. And then it's like, that's obviously incredibly frustrating, a huge friction point. The punishment though is just a 10% reduction of your item durability, which is meaningless. Like, it really is not a punishment at all. So after going through that a few times, your equipment can become dangerously damaged, then you might have to pay some in-game currency to repair it. It's not real friction, but it's the first actual kind of like stop moment in the game. It's the moment where the game says, look, no, your characters just can't do this. And at that point, then you start having to pay attention to loads of the flags that have been in the game all along that you've been able to ignore for so far. And one of those is, for example, sometimes enemy health bars have a kind of purple halo around them. I remember noticing this over and over again in my first few playthroughs. And then actually, I did have to Google it, which is not great. You should be able to go into the game itself and question it somehow. And it should be flagged somewhere. I don't want a tutorial moment where it says, if the red blip blip is blub, then this means that. And have to sit through that, because I would not pay attention. I'd skip through it. But there should be somewhere within the game. I'm sure it is in the game. I couldn't find it. It was way easier to Google it. And then it's like, okay, well, that means they're vulnerable. And I said, okay, what, emotionally? I mean, what do you mean vulnerable? Like, I'm hitting them with knives. They're probably quite vulnerable to knives. And it's like, okay, so it's status effects, only certain status effects. And then you have to sort of, okay, with the rogue, one of your main skills is a button on your taskbar that you press to imbue a bunch of other attacks with a status effect. One of them is darkness, and what that means, I think it's called darkness, what that means is when they die under that status effect, they explode and hurt everyone around them. Cool. Another one is poison, and that obviously does damage over time. Another one is ice that slows them and also does a little bit of damage, blah, blah, blah. And then you start thinking, okay, so all of these make people vulnerable, and then suddenly the items you're picking up deal extra damage to vulnerable. And then suddenly you're looking at the gems, the gem fragments you're picking up, and you're molding them into bigger gems. And the gems are saying, okay, plus 20% to vulnerable damage versus vulnerable. And it's like, before I had not even really paid attention to vulnerable as a status before. But vulnerable is, in fact, an incredibly important status in this game. And this is the sort of like the path you go down with Diablo. This is, you start going into theory crafting, you start going in, you brilliantly Diablo 4, endless credit to Blizzard for this. You can just right click on skills to pull points out of them in your skill tree and then put them into other skills. You can respec your character very, very quickly and easily once you've gotten through the game once. And you can really try lots of different builds and lots of different kind of like interesting affixes that kind of boost damage versus vulnerable, in my case, for the rogue. And that's extremely, extremely useful. And it's one of those things where it's sort of, if they'd have front-loaded that stuff, no one would have played this game. The fact that these are sort of like moments that you encounter, and then if you're invested enough, then you investigate, and then the resources are there, often outside of the game. But also, there is that depth to dig into beyond just the surface level of hitting things. That I think it's very carefully designed, and I think it kind of geniusly designed. Really, like I just really think that they have understood the rhyme and sort of like rhythm of how people engage with the game, and they have sort of created pathways within the way that skills are described, and skills have tags attached to them, and then tags refer to skill tree icons, and that's the sort of thing you wouldn't notice just blasting through the game, but then it becomes really important later. So when you're getting sort of additional effects, it will say this will affect marksman. And then you go through all your skills and they've got marksman tags, and you're like, okay, so that will give me 10% damage if they're vulnerable on this particular skill, and so on and so forth. And in fact, it's like sort of, I just felt like I've been gently basted.
If you know, you're in now.
I'm in, and I'm in. And then, of course, a huge part of this is obviously going outside of the game to where people are. Been theorycrafting for this. I also really tried to hold off on going to forums and going to Reddit and stuff, because I really want to figure it out for myself, and I really want to find the fun myself, and that's kind of like a big part of it. And then often I find when I go to Reddit and see what people are doing, that it's like this, you know, quote unquote best thing to do, or the biggest DPS for a particular class, in W3 in particular, it's the least fun thing to do. This is the least fun way to play the game. In Diablo 3, it was the Barbarian Whirlwind ability, where you just hold down 2 on your keyboard, and it would spin round and round and round. And if you had all of the affixes and you had all the your character built perfectly with the great equipment, it would just destroy everything. But then it's not a game anymore. And there's this weird point where it stops being a game. So I'm kind of like hovering in the middle zone, a very fun middle zone where I'm enjoying reading people's takes on the characters and how they like to play, but I'm holding off on reading how to play the character quote unquote correctly in order to get the best damage. And I feel as though that's where I'm at with like not just Diablo but like Destiny and like loads and loads of other games that I've played, where like I don't have the time. I don't care enough to become to go through the best things. I just want to hang out and have a good time.
Well, I think it's also like to your point earlier about what did I get out from like assessing that experience after the fact. What did I get from this? Like the point of Diablo isn't to beat it, right? Like in the sense of like I technically did the most. It's possible to do. You know, one person will accomplish that. And good for them, but it should presumably be to have fun with the systems you are presented with. And you know, I think that has an interesting relationship with community metas and so on. Like if the community is having fun sharing build ideas with each other and digging in the systems together, that's also valid. But it's a bit like, I think sometimes, and this is maybe just a broader internet phenomenon, there can be a sense that like, because it is communal, rather than simply social, it is, and because it's kind of decided by consensus, that it's somehow the law. You know what I mean? That like, once your brain has been infected with the truth of what the most effective build is, you're wrong for doing anything else, right? Which it's like, it's interesting, like just in the sort of social pattern of that, you know, it's one thing for you to come up with it yourself. It's another thing for a friend to give you some advice or some tips or to show you something you want to mimic. And then it's another thing to kind of receive it as wisdom from a more kind of dispersed community. And I think it's kind of like an interesting, I think you see that paradigm play out in tons of different forms online, not just about games, but I think it's an interesting, interesting manifestation of it.
Well, there's a sort of curve there, isn't there, of actual player agency. So as you master the system, your agency goes up. And then there's a point at which there is one possible solution that is optimal, and then your agency drops right back down again. It suddenly becomes quite uninteresting.
Yeah, right. But it's the journey that's the point, right? to that point. And actually, I mean, I do think, so I have, you know, I'm on a big Destiny hiatus at the moment, for reasons I won't dig into super on the pod, but like given that it had this year, like a fantastic expansion, it then almost lost me immediately, which I thought was kind of an interesting phenomena. But part of that is like realizing, if to abstract it out, forget rather than get into the details, I've realized that the times I've been really into that game is when I've wanted to move with the crowd. Like I've wanted to know the meta. I've wanted to chase down the builds and guns that people say are good and then practice with, you know, and so on. I want to be part of it. And then when I'm more interested in self-motivated experiences, that interest drops off. Like I don't find it a great platform for that really. Like, and so that pendulum very much swung from one side to the other. And now I haven't played it in a few months, in favor of other things, but yeah.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to contrast Diablo with Destiny because for me, Diablo has been a deeply impersonal game. Like, it really is such a number crunching game at its core, particularly, you know, beyond the normal level. Whereas for me, like, I absolutely love Destiny. Like you, Chris, I've drifted away from it. But Destiny was a complicated and a deep pressing RPG system where you did have to get a degree of accomplishment in order to attempt raids and attempt certain challenges. So there was that kind of not DPS check, but like a kind of, you know, a character like check,
investment check.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. But actually, it's because it was the co-op aspect, and it was you know, doing those raids with friends, and it was not a, a sort of impersonal forum kind of, you know, fine honing every aspect of the character. It was like, all right, so I want to get the stuff so that I'm useful, and I'll be able to raid with you and Phil this weekend. And, you know, that's kind of, that's a vast difference in experience from this to Diablo. It's a different thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I think good examples, like, I think Destiny struggled to balance. It's, I think there's something really healthy about, like, groups forming, like, localized metas, right? Like, how a group likes to achieve something. Games, particularly like MMOs, have the struggle of, like, balancing for the most dedicated players, and that is often going to be rallied around community consensus and so on. And it's a really tricky thing to get right. And I think, you know, latter day Destiny raiding, I think, really struggled to find that balance. Like, you know, the days of blind raiding, where you went in blind on the first day and figured out the mechanics yourself, kind of died because the raids had to be hard enough to test the best people in the world on day one.
Yeah.
And so you know, you would go in day one to see it, but then you'd wait for the best team in the world to beat it, and then you'd kind of look up the mechanics, because the odds of your team of, like, well-intentioned, like, you know, late 30 somethings actually figuring it out yourselves was, like, vanishingly small. You know what I mean? Like, it would be enough to figure out a mechanic. You know what I mean? Like,
but I remember, like, I think, like, Chris, we went in and I think we did do, like, a kind of first time run. Like,
yeah,
this was years ago, and we all had the time. That's the key, that's the main thing, is that we all had all of Sunday to sort of devote to it, and it was incredible. It was the best co-op experience I've ever had in any game, because it was like puzzle solving, it was chatting, it was just such a social experience. Like, it was
I do remember that really fondly. But we had the equivalent attempt this year with the raid in the new expansion, and literally, like, most the way to think about Destiny encounter design for raids particularly is often about, like, there is a series of puzzles and actions you can take that will establish, like, a stable loop, right? Like, of unlocking a DPS phase and then back to the start of the loop again, right? And we didn't even get as far as the first part of a stable loop for the first encounter in, like, 4 or 5 hours. It was so much harder than it, you know. Yeah, wow. And that's just kind of demoralizing, right? Because at that point, you've had no loot or any other kind of reward, and you're just kind of like, we should look it up. And I think that was a tricky balancing act. But yeah, like, I think that's an interesting like problem space for a developer, because, you know, different parts of the community have really different expectations for that sort of thing. But I agree with you that, like, solving those sorts of problems together in a smaller group without referring to that kind of bigger, broader body of knowledge is really, really satisfying and a very hard thing for games to consistently capture.
I feel as though inevitably developers are going to have to cater to their most devoted and intensely dedicated players. But I'd love to know, like, as a player, like, when to get involved, and, like, because there's all in that journey to that stage, because it means they're successful. The game is successful if they've reached that stage, and there's always a sweet spot sometimes in that acceleration where a new player can go in, get the good gear and have the best time, and then it sort of fades away. There's almost like a sweet spot.
Yeah. I don't think there's, I truly don't think there's a formula for this. I think it's an incredibly complex problem, but I do think there's another tension, I often think about this in terms of tensions, between where and how a developer of a game like this, like usually like an MMO target type game, gets to choose what the chase will be, or what the identity of their game will be at a high level, right? Like, in Destiny's case, players identified that raids and those kinds of, like, puzzle raids were the end game PvE thing, right? And so, because whatever that thing is, you are kind of bound to escalate, to build on it, and so on. And that creates that arc you're talking about, where eventually you will start to lose people. And then you start to think about ways to mitigate that, and so on. But nonetheless, you're then working within that problem space. Whereas it is hypothetical that, like, you know, hypothetically, Destiny could have chosen not to support that at all. Not to not have the experience, but to not escalate, right? To say that it's always about this difficulty. And if that means that the hardcore 0.5% burn themselves out and get bored and go off, then that's a cost of that, and they probably wouldn't do that. But it's not as the logical steps you take aren't as like prescribed as they might sound. Like, well, we had to do this because this is what was popular about our game. Like, there is a degree of steer that is possible, which can often be counterintuitive, or again, you know, it can involve taking more risks in certain regards, and there's all of the risk profile element of that. But I find it really interesting because it's like, it is possible for a game to be successful in a way that then becomes a trap for its developers, which is really interesting, where it's like players just like to do this one thing. So I guess that's our game now. And that can come at the expense of the game, basically.
It's like, should there be a sort of like a crunch point where you have to choose your audience, where you just have to pick? And it's a sort of, you really do have to lose people to gain other people, or service one at the expense of other.
I think it's hard to reconcile with a growth at all costs mentality, which is sort of like where things live. But I think it's a valuable thing to identify, like, this is the experience we're trying to provide, this is the audience we're trying to reach, and other goals are secondary to that, right? Not everything can be priority one. A game cannot be best in class in every single category, that kind of goes without saying. So you're obviously going to make choices about where you want to be best in class, right? Like, and where you simply want to be good or average, right? Also perfectly okay to pick areas to be okay at, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, practically. But yeah, I don't expect... wouldn't expect players to always sit in those terms, because obviously you kind of want to get the most out of everything you do. But I think practically, to make anything good, you have to pick. And I think Destiny is a really interesting case of a game sort of discovering by accident the thing that actually made it special, which was those early raids. You know, it wasn't necessarily like the big flagship feature. It was almost like a side project to do Vault of Glass. And then,
I think Destiny is really interesting because it's sort of, I think it's reached its intended 10-year life cycle or whatever.
It's keeping going, but its story has ended in that sense.
So I think it's something like I'd like to dip back into and play the latest expansion just for the story, just to see how it all
comes together. It's really
good. It sounds awesome, and it's still a beautiful game. I love the, you know, what they did, but it's one to come back to, I think, in a future pod.
Indeed. Is it time?
Is it time for what?
For me to go on a big old ramble about Dragon Age. Oh, boy. Two different comfort zone role-playing games in this podcast.
Yeah.
Dragon Age, The Veilguard, the fourth Dragon Age game. And I think notably, the first traditional BioWare game in actually a long-ass time. Right, like we haven't had, it's been more than 10 years, I think, at this point, because Inquisition was the last one. Obviously, a lot of the studio's effort went into... Andromeda was the last proper BioWare game, Mass Effect Andromeda in 2017. I remember that because I reviewed it as I was just after I left PC Gamer. But so actually I'm wrong about that, but yeah, so it's been still not been a fair old while. 2017 is still scarily like 7 years ago, and I've played 50 hours of Veilguard, and I'm getting into what I strongly suspect is either the final third or the final quarter, but I've not finished it yet. And man, so I'll say a few things. It is the Mass Effect 2 of Dragon Age 2s. And
okay,
that adds up to 4, which is the number that this is. So that's that's my review. It's really interesting, and I think it's very difficult to talk about any of these games without talking about like what are kind of like Dragon Age, I think, is a really interesting series for a lot of reasons, and has a really long legacy of rough starts, identity crises, real like sort of big narrative swings and misses, and sometimes hits, and so on, and of fostering a pretty kind of strong community under its auspices that really kind of love it for what it is. And the new one is a really interesting entry into that legacy, because in some ways it's exactly the same. It has an identity crisis. It bears all of the hallmarks of trying to be so many different games. That, you know, Mass Effect's a really interesting series. Like, Mass Effect 2, obviously, is the comparison I'd make, because Mass Effect 2 is the moment that Mass Effect kind of decided. Mass Effect 1, unsteady, experimental. Is it an RPG? Is it a shooter? Is it an open world game? Is it a driving game? Right? What is it going to be? And then Mass Effect 2 going like, nope, this is a stage-based shooter with RPG elements. And it kind of tightens its focus onto that. Dragon Age has had an even weirder journey where it's a traditional CRPG, then it's a slightly more console friendly CRPG with a much more tight story. Then it's an open world game with huge borrowings from Ubisoft, and now it's God of War, basically. And the Mass Effect 2 comparison comes in kind of neatly because it's much more stage-based, about kind of like going through linear but sort of spectacular environments on missions rather than exploring open worlds and so on. And its new formula, if every Dragon Age game has a different formula, the new one is really like, I would say, the new God of War, Mass Effect 2, and contemporary fantasy, which is my way of trying to phrase what I mean when I talk about some synthesis of elements of cozy fantasy as a relatively recent thing, and like Critical Role and Dragon Age itself and its impact on fantasy, which I can also unpack into a new version of that. And it is also, and I think this is one of the things that's sort of weird about it, it's also a Dragon Age sequel. And so in addition to its kind of identity crisis based on what this new Dragon Age game will be as opposed to the previous ones, which brings a whole ton of stuff with it, which I will unpack. It is also a direct sequel to not just Inquisition, but the DLC that followed Inquisition, as part of a kind of fairly kind of consistent, messy, but kind of grand in its own way, unfolding of the inner workings of the Dragon Age universe that began with the first game and has just sort of continued with every subsequent game. And that lends itself to the elephant in the room, which it has a spectacularly rough first 10 hours in my mind. And I think it's like to the point where I admittedly, you know, been out of this particular like fandom for a while, but I came very close to being done with it. And like, I persevered, and now I got into a rhythm with it that I think I've now genuinely found enjoyable. Like, now I'm enjoying myself. But to kind of unpack why I think it struggles initially, because, well, there's a bunch of reasons. Some of them are really simple, but some of them are really pronounced. One of them is you come into a story and a setting that is in the process of exploding based on the events towards the end of Inquisition. Like, really big sort of paradigm shifting stuff for that fantasy setting. Dragon Age has always been a kind of, I would kind of put it in the kind of Brandon Sanderson-y kind of logical, rational fantasy. Is that a good word for it? Like, there's like strong world building rules underpinning everything, and everything has a reason why it works the way that it does. In the fiction, in the game, some things are crystals. That's the reason, the rationale. But in the fiction, there's like a strong reasoning behind everything, and how the magic works, and how souls work, and creatures work, and magic, and the world itself. And Inquisition pushed all that stuff to a very nerdy inflection point. And Veilguard picks up, both in universe and in real life, 10 years later, with that stuff being dialed up to 11, and you, as a new character, thrust into the middle of it, having to deal with the aftermath of all of this stuff. And so, from the onset, it's very, very, very pacey, and it gives itself the burden of meticulously introducing all of its game systems, which is one burden of information, introducing kind of meta systems and stuff that feel a lot more complex than they actually are when you get into the meat of them. And frankly, getting you to care about a story that I think, because of its pacing issues early on, really resists being cared about. Like, it's a lot of exposition. And early on, I found it like more funny than not. Because of its, you know, it almost has like that, to talk, there's actually a lot of our conversations from tonight that I think tie up in this. One is, I think in an attempt to make sure that you can't possibly miss what's going on, almost every attempt, almost every opportunity to really like characterize the new companions or add some depth to the world is given up in favor of exposition. And it leads to long sequences with probably the most extraordinary amount of recapping I have ever seen in a game, where in the space of a minute of play, characters will recap what's currently happening and why you should care at least three times. It's like every 20 seconds. And so you get this kind of like, it's just like a box of fireworks with a match dropped into it at first. And the structure for a while almost feels like the BioWare formula has kind of rattled itself apart a bit because of just how frenetic it is. And also because of how afraid it feels. It feels like it's afraid of losing you, right? Like you won't get it, rather than just sort of letting you discover it at your own pace. And it leads to like, it becomes unintentionally funny because you'll go into a cutscene and you'll be told like, hey, we better not let Evil Greg's planning to touch the crystal. If Evil Greg touches the crystal, the world is doomed. And you'll get three responses for your character, like supportive, sarcastic, or mean. And you'll say mean, and your character will cross their arms and say, there's no way I'm letting Evil Greg touch that crystal because then the world would be doomed. All right, let's recap two. Then the scene will end and you'll go back to play and your companion characters will say to each other, if Evil Greg touches that crystal, the world is doomed. And then the other one will say, I agree. That is what will happen if that happens. And then you'll walk forward 20 meters through some linear corridors. You'll do the video game thing of like, there'll be an obvious way to go. If you go the non-obvious way to go, you will find three pieces of wood, right, which you can keep. And then you get to go the way you'll go. And then you'll walk into a room and you'll see a crystal and there'll be a guy in front of it. And he'll say, I'm Evil Greg and I'm going to touch this crystal. And then a character will say, we're going to stop you touching that crystal, Evil Greg, or else the world is doomed. And then you'll fight Evil Greg. He will shout this again during the fight. Then he'll die and say, I was going to touch the crystal. And then one of your companions will say, it's a good job you stopped Evil Greg before he touched the crystal, or else the world would be doomed. And then a pop-up will pop up and say, because you stopped Evil Greg touching the crystal, the world is not doomed. Then you'll get a journal update. So you go into the journal and it'll clarify that because you've stopped Evil Greg touching the crystal, the world isn't doomed. And you'll have maybe three new codex entries to read as several different companions reflect on the untouched nature of the crystal and or Evil Greg.
Yeah, but Chris, that's the narrative I need right now.
So it starts off like that and it has, and I don't want to rag on it too much because like it really does, it's really interesting. Like it feels like there's something to be said for, so for example, you pick a background for your character, which is actually quite important and it's threaded through really in quite interesting ways to like who you are and kind of why you were recruited by Varric, who returns from Dragon Age 2 and Inquisition to do this. And so like my character's a Grey Warden, like in the first game, and that comes up all the time. Like you meet all of the factions you could be part of and a lot of dialogue related to that is quite naturally threaded in. And in each case, there is something you did in the past that is the reason you're anyway. You have to play a relatively young character and a relatively new character, but you did something. And each of them feels like a description of what would have been like the Origins sequence if this was still Dragon Age Origins. But none of those are playable. But it's almost like you can see the shadow of a version of this game which starts with those tailored sequences and then brings you into this story that kind of, again, helps alleviate the pace. There's another sequence, which I won't kind of go into for maybe, I guess, skip forward a minute or two if you really care, but there's a whole sequence where you get introduced to so many different, completely kind of spectacular, but completely disconnected fantasy environments, one after another in the course of a simple mission, cutscene by cutscene, in the space of about 5 minutes, that it feels really clear that the team had a few like spectacular locations in the back pocket that they just kind of had to use. And the long and short of this is you do a prison break for a person trapped in an evil wizard's prison that happens to also be Bioshock. Like it's under the sea. And there's spectacular fantasy whales going past, going boo, etc. But no one mentions the fact that this is happening under the sea because that's not even like the most thing that's going on. So, and it's not really ever explained why it's under the sea. You just for 20 minutes you're under the sea, and then it's like
it
back
could be
again.
Anywhere else, Chris. Wasn't this?
Yeah,
has this been established?
And so initially, it really struggles to establish this kind of rhythm and sense of pace, particularly because like your home base in the new one is an extra dimensional lighthouse in the Fade, which is like Dragon Age's magic dimension, dream dimension, and it's connected to the rest of the world by like these magic mirrors that have again been in Dragon Age since the beginning of Origins. That give you like a teleport network around the world. And so you're kind of intervening on behalf of the world by going through this network of magic mirrors, which kind of like Dragon Age 2 codifies fast travel as kind of like the way you get around, takes away the sense of a journey. There's lots of stuff in there that's kind of in the meat of it. But what happens after a certain amount of time is the game just slows the fuck down and it finds a bit of space to kind of breathe. And it's around the time you recruit all of the companions. And it sort of settles into its rhythm a bit. And the story kind of beds in and it gives you the opportunity to just start picking over all of these in different environments and doing side missions and so on. And that's when I've really started to enjoy it a lot more. And like, I think for me, it's become like, it is comforting. And there is something like it's comfort food of a game. And there's something about its patterns and its quality of life affordances and so on. And its accessibility, frankly, that I'm finding really enjoyable. Like, it's really clear. It feels really interesting to play like a AAA fantasy role-playing game that was developed in parallel with Baldur's Gate 3, but has come out a year later, where it's the opposite game, right? And frankly, Baldur's Gate 3, I think, is one of the best games ever made, definitely one of the best role-playing games ever made. And I don't think Veilguard is. Like, I don't think it's bad, but I don't think it's in that category, right? Like, I'm not sure what I would give it if I reviewed it, but it's in that 8 territory, I think, for me, right? Whereas I think, you know, Baldur's Gate 3 is a true all-timer. It feels a lot less nutritious as a meal, but in that sense of like a AAA game, like a God of War game, that process of like cracking open and fully exploring and completing these like puzzle environments, slightly Metroidvania-y puzzle environments as you thread together different unlock abilities and puzzles and so on, is just sort of satisfying at a basic level. And all these affordances, like rather than showering you in, like, it's interesting where they've streamlined things. So it's, you know, they've kind of really lifted restrictions on how you express yourself. So like transmog is available by default. Any piece of equipment you found, you can just kind of make that your appearance, which takes away some of the weight of anything you do, but means like it gets kind of closer to the kind of like, well, I like the way this looks and I want to wear this other piece of gear for the stats. Just let me have this fantasy play out the way I would like it to play out. And that kind of feels positive. Like the way the loot system works is any given piece of gear can be kind of improved and leveled up to 10 based on a kind of meta progression thing. But as you find duplicate copies of the same gear, it also goes up the rarity tiers. So it still has the common, uncommon, sort of rare, legendary tiering. But rather than you having to find a new version of something, finding the same thing again just levels it up to the next version of itself, and they unlock these sort of stacking bonuses, which prevents your inventory getting full of useless stuff, because basically rather than having like 100 magical staves in the game, there's basically like 15, but they all have 4 tiers of rarity. And the higher tiers bring in like quite interesting, often rule-breaking things into its combat system. And its combat system is really good. Like, it's not really good in the Baldur's Gate, you can sort of crack this problem space open any way you like and be incredibly creative way. It's good in the sense that it's interesting, the games we've talked about on this pod, because it is truly somewhere between a character action game and Diablo. Like, it's about these, like, you don't control the companions anymore. They work much more like Mass Effect companions, where they are there and you can bring up a pause menu and get them to fire off specific abilities. There are a ton of status effects and then a ton of abilities that also act as primers. And if an enemy has that status effect and you hit them with a detonator for that status effect, they get frozen in time and then explode. And that can kind of be stacked with other things. And like, you have like takedowns and an ultimate and like all of these different bars that fill up. And I won't get into all the weeds of it, but I'm playing as a mage and the build crafting is like genuinely fun to like figure out ways to sort of I think it feels fairly like structured in that way, that you kind of gain quite a lot of power quickly. And I'm playing, which I would recommend playing at the not the highest difficulty, but the one above normal, because it adds a bit of friction to it. But it's an RPG where you can go into an encounter that is 10 levels ahead of you and beat it by playing the mechanics well, which feels like through a character action where like dodging at the right time, because it also has, you know, perfect parries and other sort of like traditional character action games layered on top of that kind of RPG fundamental. And like it starts to layer up in these sort of really gratifying ways. So for example, the mage has every class, mage, warrior, rogue, has two weapons that you switch between. And the mage is either a staff or the one I'm using more, which is like a dagger and orb combo. And the idea is that the light attack is the orb, which is like a projectile, a short-range projectile, and the heavy attack is the dagger. And at the basic level, every time you hit someone with the orb, it doesn't do a lot of damage, but it adds a stack of a debuff called Arcane Mark. Arcane Mark is the counterpart to Evil Greg. and then once an enemy has three stacks of Arcane Mark, that transforms into Arcane Bomb. If you then hit with them with the knife, the bomb explodes, right? Like that's kind of layer it three times, then explode it. At this point, like close to end game, very high level, that is now like triggering on two stacks rather than three. If someone dies with stacks still on them, those stacks spread to nearby enemies. The bomb itself is bigger and also spreads stacks. And my my combo is now like three hits with the orb, and then I hold the heavy attack button, which causes the knife to fly out in a spinning pattern and then like come back. And if I do it again, as it returns to my hand, it goes out again and does that to a different enemy. Or I can do a fourth orb hit and hold that, which causes the orb to start orbiting around me, applying the stacks to everything. And I'm also chaining this with like teleport strikes and like chain lightning stuff that stuns in a radius. And I can see Tom like nodding.
Yeah,
like,
I'm sorry. Our listeners can't see this, but I'm doing big, slow yes nods.
Yeah.
Like, I'm in. I'm in. Yeah, that sounds like good stuff. Like, and like, yeah, I want to detonate a bunch of goblins.
Right. And that's, and so for that reason, that the encounters themselves are like relatively repetitive, like, but it feels nice to go and kind of, you know, I'm still kind of like happy to do them. You know what I mean? Like, I'm kind of having fun with it.
I think it's really good that there's a space for just a normal 30-hour RPG that isn't supposed to take over your life. I think that's actually like a narrative RPG, a narratively driven thing. Like a whenever another witch comes out or something else. I like weirdly, I've been playing the Avatar game that Ubisoft made.
Oh yeah, I was really interested in playing that.
Yeah, so it's absolutely beautiful, and there's some things to recommend, but it's so obsessed with its with the crafting and the open world grinding of, you know, extracting resources from the environment. That it actually, I mean, which is hilarious, given that it's a fun gully thing about not, you know, destroy the environment in order to better yourself. That is in fact the entire game mechanically. and also the other fun thing is that, of course, there are the thing with Avatar is that it's a reference to Fern Gully, but basically, you're a giant blue person on a beautiful planet full of gorgeous nature, and the native people are deeply in tune with their environment, but evil humans have come to build factories and suck all the resources out, and everything goes in the game brown and dead, and you have to, in true Ubisoft game fashion, knock down an outpost in order to regenerate everything in the local area.
See, now I'm doing the slow nod. Yeah.
Yeah.
Give me an outpost.
And what I would say is, once you've got some good equipment, it's really fun to do that. And the other fun thing about it is that it's a gorgeous game. It's beautiful to travel around. In the first few missions, it gives you a dragon that you can just ride around all over the place. And when you go to new areas, you have to sort of unlock it to do a very simple mission. But basically, the sense of freedom, being able to land anywhere, jet off, and just fuck off the natives and go somewhere else is basically a key part of the freedom and fun of the game. And actually dominating these kind of giant human-built complexes on this beautiful planet with your bow and arrow is really fun. But they accidentally, like, the all the foliage and the world is beautiful. They accidentally made all the human constructed stuff absolutely gorgeous. Like, in terms of, like, the industrial design, I was looking at it, I was like, oh, that's so good. There's a bit where I had to destroy, like, a giant sort of mining rig, and it was like a giant spider across the land in the middle of this foliage, and I was just, like, looking it through these glowing leaves as night was falling. It's got this full day-night cycle that's beautifully observed. And I was like, oh. I mean, I'm going to break it for parts so I can level up, but it's so good. They got some really good artists in to design the human stuff in this game. It's hard to recommend because the crafting and the sort of the cloying eternal Captain Planet nonsense of the Avatar universe is a constant irritation. But in the moments in between all of that stuff, where you could just get on your dragon, fly somewhere, batter a bunch of mechs with some giant bows, and then smash a complexes. Those are really good. Those outpost moments in all Far Cry, it's a reskin of Far Cry, basically. So all those Far Cry moments are always good. And I wish they'd just strip away so much of it and just focus to, like, make a game about the outposts without any of the sort of endless nonsense and having to listen to the tribe is.
I think, like, actually a really good segue to something to a Dragon Age thing, which is there's that core, like, so I really wanted to, like, unpack, like, that satisfying core loop, right? Whether it's the outpost thing or in Dragon Age thing, just the kind of, I don't know if we have a good word for it. Like, in a non-open world game with, like, large levels, what it means to, like, find all the chests, you know what I mean? To, like, really unpack the environments and unlock all the routes. And it really is a game of, like, environmental puzzles that start off very simple, but get to the point where they're never hard, but they're, like, you know, give you a little thing to think about and you feel nice for solving it, right? But you don't have to look at a guide, which is the sweet spot for me. Like, you can just sort of, like, and you get a little treat for having done it. And then on top of that, though, is, like, the thing that, what I find really fascinating about this is all of that is pretty successful. None of it truly is what, talking about, you know, the thing saying earlier, like, where games choose what to be best in class at. Truthfully, what the, you know, what matters, I think, to fans of BioWare games and to the community for Dragon Age particularly is the narrative, right? Like, is the story, right? Like, the core mechanics of the series have changed radically with every single game. So the fact that it has retained an audience can't be due to that, right? Like, no one, you know, people do miss a particular game and its era, but truly it's about this narrative. And the new one's really interesting, and there's a lot to unpack about its writing. And I've seen the hot takes, and I've seen the back and forth about it. And I'm going to do a typical me thing and offer, like, a measured take on this, because I think there are moments where the writing and the voice acting really do fall short. Like, either they're too heavy with exposition, even the voice acting, which is, I think, good for the central cast a lot of the time, has its moments. All BioWare games are like this. All video games are like this, frankly, where you get that kind of veering line between that was a genuinely well-delivered joke or this kind of emotional beat has landed, to things that really, really sound like Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. Like, you know, you do get, like, the occasional side character that just is like Richie Ayoade's character from Dark Place, right? Like, but, and so it is a bit hit and miss. And also, I think it's worth calling out, and I do genuinely say this with love, I think Dragon Age has always had, like, a profound relationship with being cringe. Like, I think they're just, it's just sort of, like, written into Dragon Age's DNA from the moment of the This Is The New Shit trailer to, like, it's kind of, you know, where it takes big leaps in terms of fantasy world building to where it sort of, like, plays the hits and so on. And I'm trying to think of the best way to break down the new one. It's, in some ways, as a fan of that series and as someone who's, like, read all the Dragon Age novels, it's kind of a treat. Because Marsh just did a look that I think was, like, literally, like, I've just seen something popped up that says, because you said that, Marsh will die in the final mission. it's almost like frankly, they're kind of getting through the lore and like unpacking the story and revealing things and answering long-standing speculation about that universe, like it's going out of fashion, right? Like they might, like a bit like a TV show that only has one season to answer all your questions. Here comes Dragon Age to just fucking answer some shit, like about dragons and ages and the things that happen in them. And that some of that stuff's genuinely exciting. There are some really good set pieces in it. But then the other thing that's really interesting is it's really quite low stakes at the same time. Even while sort of like having a few moments of genuine drama, it also feels like someone has identified that one of the stresses of a BioWare game is the fact that you're going to have to make really tough decisions. And so, at least as I've played it so far, it does throw a few curveballs at you in terms of decisions. But it's sort of quite humane with them, weirdly. Like, characters are very forgiving. And I've seen this raised as a critical flaw, but I find it's like an interesting evolution of the BioWare formula. The traditional BioWare formula is you assemble a gang of rascals, and half of them hate each other for reasons that are backstory assigned, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, each of them is a representative of their part of the fiction, and they have reasons to hate or distrust each other. And it's only by you being their best friend that they'll learn to work together. Whereas the entire set of companions in Veilguard are just nice. They're just really reasonable. Like, they may come from like diverse kind of backgrounds and worldviews, but they all kind of agree that stopping Evil Greg is more important than anything else. And so a lot of that can be kind of put aside. And it makes for a really interesting contrast, I think. And there's a strange part of me that initially, well, I'll sidebar, there is something going on with it, which I'm reluctant to view as a flaw because it's so widespread now that I think it's more like a genre signifier or a stylistic choice that can be executed well or badly. And that is characters that have clearly had a lot of effective therapy, right? They talk to one another, even in moments of emotional distress, like people who are really well adjusted and know how to talk about their feelings. And they have been written as characters in quite a modern sense, as people who like there is a lot of therapy speak and there is a lot of like kind of reasonable decision making. Like, and as a main character, you're really limited to just being like really nice, kind of making shit jokes, or like reminding people to like, basically you can't be any meaner than like someone in a meeting who reminds everyone we've only got 5 minutes left. Like, that's the level, you know, from like Renegade Shepherd, you kind of reduce to like, hey, everybody, just to, this is great, but we just did not, I don't want to time cop, but yeah, okay. Elven gods. Like, that's kind of, very occasionally you can be a bit more ruthless than that. And I don't know whether I dislike this or not, truly. Go ahead, Tom.
I was chuckling when you said that, Chris, because like a couple of episodes ago, we were talking about God of War and about like, how Thor is like an alcoholic and he's been to AA meetings and like that kind of like really, you know, and it's cool to, you know, everyone should go to therapy, but part of me thinks that it's sort of in this fantasy context is the death of drama.
It is.
Because like you can't, some people have to just go out on their path because they're so determined to do it that things happen. Like some things have to happen and people have to make those things happen. And if everyone's just like, well, mediating it, then that's a kind of, it inhibits the drama, right?
Yeah, it does. And like, truthfully, with my like writer hat on, that is my view. Like that, like, I think fantasy is the domain for like big feelings and unreasonable people. And I think again, not to raise it up again, but Baldur's Gate, like every character in Baldur's Gate is an asshole, right? Like, and they made that kind of interesting decision to like not have the normal way around is everyone's kind of nice, but you have to recruit one dickhead. Like, and that's the rule. Whereas like, honestly, and I say this with love, every Baldur's Gate companion is basically a dickhead for a different reason. And all of them have got into a kind of like, you know, murder, suicide sex pact with God of some kind, and are all also the bus from Speed. Like, that's all of them.
it's so much fun.
Right. And they've obviously, you know, and actually, pointedly, the in the absence of a Dragon Age game, I think a lot of the Dragon Age community sort of flocked to Baldur's Gate as a source of, like, fucked up rascals, you know what I mean, to kind of to kind of adopt. And the new one, I think it will achieve the same thing, because there are moments where being able to make a decision in an argument between two characters and have both of them go like, oh, actually, you are right, is like a fantasy fulfillment, where it's like, you know, oh, I could, as a conflict avoidant person, wow, this was, you know, it's like nice to not have to worry too much. But I've only like, but truly, like, the stakes are, have never been more medium. Like, they've, and I think that is to the detriment of drama. Like, truly, I think there isn't like a ton of dramatic meat on the bone in some ways, even as the storytelling does improve markedly, and there are good moments in it, but it feels like more being along for the ride. Crucially, it takes out a lot of the anxiety that I could make the wrong decision and kind of screw up the story for myself. It feels a lot more like I'm kind of aesthetically inflecting how I want the story to feel, but not making too many huge decisions. I did unmake a decision because I didn't really like how it turned out, and I wasn't aware that it was going to be sprung on me. Save all the time, everybody. And I did change a different decision only because I didn't like what piece of armor it gave that companion. So I wanted to see both, and then I went with the one that had the cooler armor because I didn't really care too much about the actual choice was a bit nothing.
It's quite telling.
Yeah.
It's quite telling about the characterization of.
Yeah.
Look, I'm talking as a Diablo player who always picks armor over character development.
So. Yeah, some of the characters are like the characters are like likable. The performances are good. Like there's a few like good incidental conversations between them. They've done tons of stuff to kind of like try and level up that part of the bio experience. Like every time you return to home base, where the characters actually physically are, is kind of randomized. And they might be together having conversations with each other rather than in their rooms, basically. They form romances independently of you if you're not like pursuing them in that way. And there's tons of conversations and stuff like that. And the other thing I'll say, and I think this is a really important call out because I've seen it raised, and I'll call this out in the sense that, given my life experience, I'm not in a good place to judge its success in this regard, but it leans in really quite hard and very intentionally in terms of like queer and trans representation specifically. It's one of the only, I think it's, I'll be corrected on this, but I think it's the only like certainly mainstream role playing game I've played that not only lets you choose to play as a trans character, but thoroughly writes that into the story, like with a lot of extra dialogue and so on. And there's a plot for one of the companions, without spoilers, that also involves a journey of that kind. And you sort of intentionally indicate quite early in the game through a sequence, sort of like you have the option to commit, like to say, you know, I consider my character to be trans and that's their life experience and so on. And I've, you know, from doing some reading around the game, like I've seen people critiquing its handling of that from that perspective, and I've seen people really grateful for it. I think it's worth calling out that it was Inquisition's inclusion of a trans character that got it singled out by the pre-Gamergate brigade, but the nascent Gamergate movement, as the enemy initially, and actually led to a lot of that movement's association embrace of CD Projekt and The Witcher as the counterpoint to what was conceived as like what was considered to be like treacherous woke fantasy. And so that was like, that was part of Dragon Age's most recent legacy, was like being, you know, that kind of was, you know, as a I should stress, like, you know, obviously spurious and kind of you know, bollocks culture war thing, was nonetheless piggybacking off the kind of the controversy of the Mass Effect 3 ending into Inquisition being having, you know, queer people in it, and like to kind of have BioWare become the enemy at the expense of CD Projekt. And I should stress, like, I think it's when developers are either villainized or held up as models by those bad actors, it sucks for everybody, right? Like it's sort of bad both ways. But it's interesting. It's nice that Dragon Age has returned and leaned in even harder to the things that it got kind of, hate campaigned for in the first case. And so those are the areas where I think, yeah, okay, there's real intent here. There's really like something, you know, kind of like a really considered thing going on. And that's what gives me pause when I say that, like, that kind of like everyone gets along nice fantasy has no place, right? Like, I think I do want this kind of story with a side of like bite, basically, with something. And I think what they are doing can be achieved with, frankly, like more drama and stronger kind of sense of like conflict and so on. But more than anything else, what it feels like to me is like a, you know, the principle of veils in D&D or tabletop role playing, like the idea of like having a conversation with your players about what they do and don't want to see. Compared to Baldur's Gate, the Veil Guard, pointedly, I would say, feels like a game where the players have said to their GM, hey, we're up for having an adventure, but I find it really stressful if the party argues among themselves. So could we just agree that for the sake of this adventure, we are going to get along and we'll argue with the villains? And if that was like almost like given as a note at the start, it makes the whole game make more sense. And I suspect that is the kind of creative direction call that's been made. But yeah, that's the sort of the sum of my thoughts on its writing. Like, I think it has some good jokes buried in the codex entries and occasionally in the delivery. And some of the twists, like ironically, making everyone nice does have some nice impact. Like, there's one of your companions is like an older gentleman death mage who is the nicest man in Dragon Age while also being a necromancer, which is just a good bit. You know, that sort of alone is sort of like, I think as a standalone, that would be a really interesting choice. He's just also joining the team of the nicest people in Thedas. Like, you know, even the guy with a demon in him loves a cup of coffee.
I'd love to sort of rerun Dragon Age Veilguard's launch if Baldur's Gate 3 hadn't come out, and to see how people would reflect on it. Because I really do feel as though people see this game as a reflection of that, which is great for her, because they're obviously developed in parallel with, you know, they're just making their own games. And Baldur's Gate 3 is a sort of established, it's unfair on Veilguard, in terms of from what you described, Crystal, what it's trying to do. It can't be that game, because if it was like a, you know, Baldur's Gate 3, it would be expansive, and actually there's lots that's very fussy and hard to play about Baldur's Gate 3 in my experience when it comes to combat, when it comes to dealing with sort of Dungeons and Dragons trappings. I think that there's lots, actually, you know, lots of barriers to new players, whereas Veilguard might be a nice, easy,
yeah,
fun story.
I think it truly is that, and I think, like, I do think it's a rough beginning. Like, I think that's where it trips over itself slightly, and that's maybe the interesting counterpoint. Like, I think Larian's like mic drop of just sort of announcing that they won't make a sequel to Baldur's Gate 3, despite it being so successful, was their like power move. It's also definitely the right call, because, you know, Dragon Age reinvents itself every time in pursuit of new audiences, and you can point to EA and EA's patterns in that, right? Like, Dragon Age as an IP has always been kind of like thrown at whatever, it feels like it's always been thrown at different genres in pursuit of like some sort of broader strategic move for EA's portfolio, maybe at the expense of Dragon Age getting to have its own identity, you know, in that regard. But also, they made this commitment, I think, as part of the BioWare brand, to like continuity, to this sense that this is like one big journey you're on. And obviously with like Shepard's Mass Effect games, that was a big part of the appeal, right? Like the continuity of the story one-to-one. Dragon Age over time is so big and so like stateful in its sort of various big world shifting things that the player can do as the various characters you play as along the way, that it is now evidently impossible for them to maintain that, right? Like, it has some cameos and touch points from the previous games. Inquisition, if you remember, they launched a whole separate website called Dragon Age Keep, where you could like manually configure the outcomes for you to granular levels of detail, down to the individual quest for both Origins and Dragon Age 2 and their various DLCs, so that kind of big web of inputs could be fed into Inquisition, and then Inquisition leaned as hard as it could into giving you some payoff for like years of these stories. Veilguard does not try. Like, you answer some really simple questions, and you do have the ability to make your Inquisitor for on character creation from Inquisition. And you answer some very simple questions about what happened in Inquisition. But other than that, it's really clear that they've realized we can't follow through on that fantasy of you getting to find out what happened to your warden from Dragon Age Origins, right? Because they could be dead in so many different ways, and this and that, and the same with Hawk from Dragon Age, and two. And so, and those aren't spoilers, like, it's just much lighter on that kind of thing than Inquisition was, because I think they've recognized, fuck, like, it's too much, right? And it's not relevant to someone coming in now. But at the same time, they've also committed to, like, telling this massive story that's taken them decades to unfold. And this game begins at, like, what feels like the beginning of its final act. And so inevitably, the beginning suffers for having to onboard you so much in a way that's probably doomed. Like, I did a bit of, like, a reminder course for myself, but, like, I had the benefit of having, like, played... I've 100%ed every single one of these games and all their DLC. And I'm having to do that thing of like, okay, why does anyone give a shit about this again? Okay, yeah. Like, and that's, so it's interesting that they're caught in this trap of like, can't quite pay off the legacy in the sense of carrying all your choices forward. They do have to kind of just ignore or retcon some stuff. But also, we still need to get new players on board with what this whole universe is, because we're chosen to kind of keep trying to drive this story forward. And I think Baldur's Gate's strength, which is how big it, like how wide its possibility space is and how many different ways it can end, particularly now, the right call is to just not do a sequel. Because I guarantee you, if they made a sequel and said, by the way, literally none of the characters from Baldur's Gate 3 that you love are coming back at all, people would be really upset. But how could they? They can all die. You can put any of them in a box and put that box in another box and then put that box in the sea. Like, that's all supported within the rich sandbox of Baldur's Gate. And so, yeah, like, there is no way for them to pay it off.
There's absolutely, obviously, if you had to put ties into those characters, there's no way, for sure. But Baldur's Gate is an open slate. There are so many different dimensions and settings and places you could set games. I think that what's great for Larian, I agree with you, Chris. I think it is a completely right decision for Larian to do this. Because I think what they want to do is create their own universe and say from the makers of Baldur's Gate 3. And that now it's been such a phenomenon. I think that carries a lot of cachet, and that will carry through to the next game. In the next however long it takes to make 3-4 years, I think people will still remember Baldur's Gate 3. I think it has been a phenomenon. It really has. Like, I'm on a sort of gaming TikTok. I'm still getting like memes and stuff from Baldur's Gate 3, and people like, you know, romancing different characters and doing really silly stuff with bears and just kind of like talk to animals. Like, there's so much kind of chaos in that game that it's become something.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you're right, and maybe this is a closing point, like, it's interesting to play something far more accessible. Like, frankly, if someone had never played, like, a narrative RPG or a choice-based kind of cinematic RPG before, I think Veilguard would be a tough recommendation on the basis that I do think its first few hours are rough. Having played it for longer, I do think they were sort of sacrificed on the altar of its much more stable and more important middle bit. And I think if you see it in the same light that you would see like JRPGs, there's plenty of JRPGs that get good at like hour 12, like plenty. Yeah. And so I think seen in that light, it's kind of a bit easier to back up. And I'm really like, I'm committed now, like, and I'm keen to see how it ends, and I'll probably check back in when I have finished it, because it feels like they have leaning quite hard into that, like, building up to a satisfying finale, which is sort of I think ultimately the right choice. But yeah, those were my rambly Dragon Age thoughts. Thank you.
Do you think EA will sweep upon the Dungeons & Dragons license and try and feed it to the Dragon Age team?
Who could speculate? I mean, like...
We can. Let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah, Crate and Crowbar will acquire the license.
We did see in CD&D. We did. We already did.
That's true. Yeah. We pitched.
Yeah, we have pitched what we would do with that license. I can't do that voice again, incidentally. But it is just an accurate impression of Marsh, so we don't need anything.
Perfect.
Yeah, indeed.
Uncanny.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, this podcast must end because I must urinate at some point, and I'd rather not do it in this chair. Mm. So thank you. What a good pod.
Thank you, Marsh.
If you have questions you want to send us, we didn't answer any today because of the aforementioned need to pee, but you can send us questions at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. You could find these videos, you could find these recordings as videos on YouTube. The address for that is youtube.com/crateandcrowbar. And you can back us on Patreon if you feel like it. That's patreon.com/crateandcrowbar. Or you can join our Discord community, who are lovely, the link for which is on our website, which is crateandcrowbar.com.
How painful is having to say the word slash over and over again?
It's all been a waste now. I've let go.
Oh, no.
The grand finale.
Yeah. Well.
I'm a very soggy Marsh Davis.
I've been Tom Senior. And thank you, gents, for a lovely, lovely chat.
I've been Chris Thurston.
And I'm saying it as slowly as possible.
Indeed. Staring directly into Marsh's eyes.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.